Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with us this morning. It is Tuesday, November the 14th. Just to get your calendar straightened out, if you were wondering what day it was, it is Tuesday. And I found this to be fascinating. I love fascinating stories. A Massachusetts man is accused of creating a license plate out of a pizza box. All right. All right. He was driving around a Buick. That should have been your first clue, with an odd-looking license plate. After pulling the man over, they discovered he had cut a rectangle out of a pizza box and used markers to write down a fake number. He was charged with driving without a license and a license plate fraud. Police are reminding drivers that it is illegal to create your own license plate. Did you know today is National Pickle Day? And here's a few fun facts about pickles. The word itself comes from the Dutch pickle, meaning brine. Julius Caesar is said to have made sure pickles were included in his troops' diet. He thought they gave them physical and spiritual strength. And as the stories go, Cleopatra credited pickles with helping her to maintain her good looks. I'm not sure pickles really makes a difference at that point, Cleo. Just got to let you know that right up front. You know, can I just be honest with you? So National Pickle Day started with support from Pickle Packers Association back in 1949. It's funny how stuff gets their start. That Pickle Packers had a say-so in 1949. There you go. All right, let's get to something way more serious, and that is a verse out of 1 Peter. I said this in the first hour. I'm going to say it again. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive in the spirit. So that is a good word for the day. We're going to talk to Dr. David Stevens. He's already on our studio line, and boy, do I have questions for him this morning. It is 6 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with us. Oh, good morning. The doctor is in. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Dr. David Stevens is from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bill. How are you doing?
You know, I'm good, except I read this headline that based on new standards, half of U.S. adults now have high blood pressure, and reading that headline just raised my blood pressure.
Well, I want to know. I heard your comment about pickles, and I helped my wife make 20 quarts of pickles this summer because I love her sweet pickles. That's how much I love them. I get in the kitchen and help her make them. So I think they cure everything and maybe high blood pressure if you don't put too much salt in them.
So what is the new standards that they've put into place that has all of a sudden added 30 million Americans to those with a condition of high blood pressure?
Yeah, we continue just to study this problem because it's so common. And what is a good blood pressure to be down to? And they have actually lowered that level, showing in some good studies that, you know, it decreases stroke, it decreases heart disease, and decreases a number of other problems, including, you know, just getting plaque in your heart. So this is a big deal, and they're trying to get us where we can be as healthy as possible. But often that is going to require more than one medicine, sometimes two, sometimes even three, to get blood pressure down in some people.
David, what is the holistic approach to bringing our blood pressure down a little bit? I've heard breathing intentionally, taking nice, long, deep breaths can help lower your blood pressure. Is stress a big factor in blood pressure? Am I generating my own high blood pressure if I had it?
I'm not saying I do. Stress does do that. And you can put monitors on and watch what happens to people while they're under stress. And it does increase blood pressure, and the more stress you have and less relaxation you have. There's also a genetic component because your parents had it. You got this genetically. You're more susceptible to it. Having too much weight on causes high blood pressure, and that's a huge issue. As you age, your blood pressure tends to get higher because your arteries get less elastic.
Okay.
And because of that, they're more like pipes instead of being elastic, and the pressure it takes more pressure from your heart to get the blood through those arteries. And so there's a number of factors. Too much salt in your diet's a huge issue. And keeping the amount of salt, I at home never add salt to anything. That's a good way to approach it. Some people have to limit their salt significantly because of their high blood pressure. So, yeah, and then you know, it's just something we live with because we don't get enough exercise either. And there's good studies showing if you just take a mile walk or 2 mile walk every day, it'll lower your blood pressure, lower your weight, and you'll feel a lot better mentally as well.
Mm-hmm. What about your wife's sweet pickles?
I try to eat them in moderation. You know what I like to do? I like a Ritz cracker with cream cheese and a pickle on it. Oh, it's like eating hors d'oeuvres. They're wonderful.
Don't tell anybody that, okay? That sounds so good. All right, here's something I heard on the news that, and I'm always kind of wanting to get more information about this because Disneyland, of course, America's favorite fun park, is had an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. And I guess I don't really ever even know what that is, and how do you get it, and who's at risk for it, and how do you get Legionnaires' disease? Is it airborne?
It is. It's airborne, and actually, if you read that whole article, you'd see that they shut down their air conditioning coolers because what happens is that's where it breeds, in the water there, and then goes in the air, and people get it. Older people are much more susceptible to it. It's a pretty serious disease. It can be treated with antibiotics, but you don't want that, you know, going through your amusement park where people can get it. So they're cleaning all that up. It happens in hotels, and you'll hear, you know, kind of like a mini epidemic in a hotel because a bunch of people were there and this stuff was being blown through the air conditioning vents or the heating vents, but mainly air conditioning, and you get the Legionnaires' disease, which can be devastating, especially for elderly people.
Yeah, David, what's the origin of it? How does it begin? What's the starting point for it?
It's a type of bacteria. That's how you compete with antibiotics, and something we've really not heard much about until, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago when people noted this and found out the cause. So, it's just an aerosolized bacteria that you're breathing in, getting into your lungs, and then get all the symptoms of a serious pneumonia, which usual antibiotics don't hit, and it takes specific antibiotics for Legionnaires' disease. So it's a big problem. And speaking of that, I mean, we're seeing so much flu and pneumonia around this fall, and people need to be quick to get to their doc. Just had one of my staff members, we were up doing a large mission conference up in Louisville, started feeling bad. Yesterday got diagnosed with pneumonia, is home. You know, he's guy 64 or something, and it's just going around. A lot of people are getting it. So take precautions. Most flu and then can go into pneumonia is not gotten by people sneezing on you. It's actually gotten by touch and touching things they've touched. So keep your hands washed and eat healthy, get plenty of sleep, get the flu shot, and try to avoid this because there's some bad stuff going around this year.
David, can you also get pneumonia from aspirating into your lungs if you choke on something or something goes down the wrong pipe? Can that turn into pneumonia?
It absolutely can. In fact, that's especially common in older hospital patients, even sometimes younger ones that are seriously ill, that they can't control their own secretions and it gets down your lung. Their gag reflex is not working very well, and they kind of coughing well, and this gets down and causes an aspiration pneumonia. That's what we call it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be extremely serious because it's a mixed bacteria and can put people in the hospital or even kill them. And it happens frequently in the hospital. That's why they're so careful to suction people out and make sure the heads of the beds are raised and all sorts of things, trying to prevent aspiration on people in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. All right. As we are looking towards the legalization and commercialization of marijuana, to me that sounds like there's going to be all kinds of moral concerns, and I'd love to have this conversation with you. We can get it started now, but I want to talk about it as well on the other side of the break. Can you get us started on this topic?
Yeah, a book I'd recommend I just finished called Weed. That's easy to remember by Ben Cort. And, you know, it just blew my socks off. I thought I knew a lot about marijuana, and I do, you know, and the dangers of it medically and all the rest. But what's happened in Colorado, Washington, Oregon, but he specifically talks about Colorado, is decriminalization has led to commercialization. In other words, people out there that are making tons of money off of this and are trying to make current users to be frequent users, trying to get new users, including your kids, and trying to create demand. In Denver, in some of the lower income areas of the city, there's one marijuana shop for every 47 people. Can you believe that?
Unbelievable.
And the other thing is, it's so much more potent. You know, people think, well, you know, marijuana's not that bad. Back in the 60s, marijuana has tetrahydrocannabinol in it. That's the substance that gets you high. It was 1% when you got, you know, somebody bought weed on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are selectively breeding it, and the average across the United States is 12%. In Colorado,
wow,
the average is 30%, 30 times more powerful to get that psychedelic effect. And that causes much more psychosis, reduced brain function, what we know as severe mental illness leading to that. And this is kind of not, I take it one time and it happens. It's a slow burn from people using it over time. They're marketing it to the young, close to schools. And then they have these THC, this tetrahydrocannabinol, infused foods and candies.
Wow.
And they don't have to be labeled.
Yeah. Oh,
that they have,
that's crazy.
That, yeah, coffee, ice cream, baked goods, suckers, soda, tea, hot chocolate, breath mints, granola, gummy bears, marinara sauce, candy bars, main course meals you can buy at the store. I mean, it's crazy. And edibles are 40% of the market now in Colorado for THC, and they are putting high doses of the active substance in them. They recommend you don't take any more than 10 milligrams of the tetrahydrocannabinol, and they're putting in one gummy bear as much as 20 times that much.
Oh,
they buy regular gummy bears, spray them with the active substance of marijuana, coat them with sugar, repackage them, and so this is just a recipe for kids overdosing. Oh, here's a gummy bear on the floor, or mommy's gummy bear, or whatever.
Yeah, David, I need to take a break. Well, let's continue this conversation. This is unbelievable to me. It's 17 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Be right back. Nineteen minutes after the hour, we're back speaking to Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association, and we're talking about the commercialization of marijuana. And David, I am stunned that some of the things you've just told me about the different number of items that THC is getting into. Now, is the primary result of taking these edibles, does it take the edge off? Does it relax you? Does it numb pain? I don't even know what it does because I've never tried marijuana.
Yeah, it makes you high. It makes you mellow, you know, spaced out. And the more you take, the more you get that way. People say marijuana doesn't kill you, and that's true. It won't. You can't overdose on it. But it does give you a psychosis and in high doses and can cause you to kill other people, driving or
sure,
kill yourself. There's suicides and all sorts of stuff going on. And when I say 10 milligrams, they say, you know, you shouldn't take more than that. This is kind of guidelines for people that are using it. They now sell a soda in Colorado that has 350 milligrams. Have you ever drunk 1/35th of a soda?
No.
I never have.
No.
I mean, but so I, you know, or eat 1/20th of a gummy bear. But, I mean, they're high. And then it gets worse. Not only are they got these edible, they have what they call concentrates. And what they do is take a PVC pipe and pack it with all the leftover stems and leaves of the marijuana plant that people don't smoke. Then they take a compressed butane container, like you'd put it for a cigarette lighter or something like that, shoot it down the pipe, and out the end comes 85 to 95% pure THC. It is so potent that half the size of a pinhead of this stuff will knock a regular marijuana user on their back. And then they put it in a vaporizer, you know, the electronic cigarettes, the things people are smoking. It doesn't smell, and they get high from that. And now we're seeing more and more increase in that use, which is even in much higher doses than what people are doing now. So this is just a huge issue.
David, you could do a late-night infomercial the way you said that. And then it gets worse.
What? Well, there's no federal control over this. I mean, you know, the FDA can't regulate because it's illegal.
Yeah. Okay, let's
go ahead.
Let's talk about the practical side and the argument that says, well, this is going to be helpful for some cancer patients and people who are seriously ill. What about that?
Well, the part of marijuana that gives you some of the medicinal effects is called CBD, just those initials. It's still only at 1%. And we know that there's other things. It's really unnecessary. There's other drugs that can do this better. That are already on the market. You can actually get THC in a tablet form. It's dangerous because there's no manufacturer, there's no FDA approval, there's no standard chemical composition to its potency and quality, no standard dosage, no safe delivery system. I mean, all sorts of problems that, well, let's just go in the backyard and grow a few plants. And that's what's happened. If you get a prescription, you can grow your own in the backyard and plus go get it at these dispensaries. And there's no tax on it. And so it's, you know, there's doctors, bad doctors online who will just write you a prescription for the money. And it's the gateway to opening it up to first medicinal use and then commercial use. And is some people helped by it? Yes. But if it can be helpful, then let's treat it like any other medicine. Let's test it. Let's standardize it. Let's dose it properly. Let's know the side effects of it, the interactions with other drugs, not just saying, it's like telling people, well, oh, yeah, morphine's good for pain. Grow some heroin plants in your backyard. Good luck.
Yeah. David, you're the perfect doctor to speak to my next question. With a couple minutes remaining, it looks like research has identified a public health threat called loneliness.
Absolutely, and I thought about this because of two reasons. One of my staff is just retired and is out helping a man who's had three strokes and taking him places and doing things with him, getting him to church, taking him fishing. He came in and talked to him about it last week. And then Thanksgiving and Christmas are coming up, those times of year when people are most lonely. We know for good science that it causes more Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, stroke, insomnia, obesity, and all these things are tied to loneliness and being alone. And this is actually a public health risk because we have more loneliness and less community in our country. And I just want to encourage people towards the end of the year to who can I reach out to and become friends, not just for a meal at Christmas, but on a long-term basis and include them in our family and some of our activities and reach out to them. It's a tremendous ministry for Christians to have.
Just the lack of social contact can really make a huge difference in a person's life, can't it?
It does. It actually stunts their ability to think, causes depression. I mean, the list just goes on and on of what loneliness does. And isolation, they're not really the same thing, but they can be together. But loneliness and isolation, and it's just spending time with people. They're doing a lot of things medically now, small group counseling and what, you know, where do you find community and what makes you happy and what makes you depressed and having friends and enjoyable activities and all these things, especially with the elderly, is they tend to be more alone and isolated. This is a great ministry for our churches to have as well as for us as individuals.
And then people that don't know Jesus as their Savior and Lord would be really in trouble.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's where we have our closest community, and that's with Christ himself.
Right.
And we need to help introduce people to him.
Well, David, I can imagine you're kind of a social guy, but then on the other hand, I can see you not being social because that way you'd have to share your wife's sweet pickles with others. And I can't picture you wanting to do that.
We made some pie jars for giving away at Christmas, but I'm going to do it very, very carefully.
Well, I'm sending you my mailing address because I want one of those pie jars.
Okay, I'll get one to you.
All right, David, thanks so much. Have a great week.
Okay.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
26 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break, and then Brad Sickler is going to be with us at 20 minutes until the top of the hour, but right now, we'll go to Breakpoint. It's 31 minutes after the hour. You're in for a big treat. Dr. Brad Sickler is already in studio. We're going to talk to him. He's the professor of philosophy here at the University of Northwestern. So get ready. We're going to have a great conversation in 9 minutes. But for now, let's go to news.
What does your teen's room look like right now? Like a bomb hit it, right? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. I often meet parents who are adamant about their teen having a tidy room and a perfectly made bed. They demand a spotless household while the relationships are in shambles. Our homes are a reflection of who we really are, and our cleanliness standards reflect what we want for our kids. So yes, we want our teens to present themselves well, but a sterile home sometimes houses sterile relationships. Do you need to make some priority adjustments today? Maybe you can lighten up a bit and quit riding your teen over his or her room. It'll create an atmosphere of rest for the whole family, even though your teen's room is still a disaster.
Find more help from Mark Gregston at ParentingTodaysTeens.org. That's ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Good morning, 24 minutes until the top of the hour. In studio, I have Dr. Brad Sickler, Assistant Professor of Philosophy, Program Director for Master of Arts in Theological Studies. So not the really useful kind of doctor. Do you know how to perform the Heimlich maneuver?
Yeah, I do. I've never had occasion to use it, thankfully.
I'm a useful doctor.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in studio. You are a regular on Connecting Faith with Ask the Professor. And Dr. Mark Muska has been on this show several times, but I'm sick of him getting all the glory.
He is a glory hound.
If there's one thing that's true about him, it's that. Yeah. So I wanted to give you equal time. I questions about philosophy. I'm always interested in those, and I want to open it up to our listeners too. If you have a burning question, you can give us a call 1-877-933.
Most people wake up with burning philosophical questions at 7 in the morning.
They do. 2484 877-933 2484. Let me get this started because when I get to heaven, Brad, I'm going to go directly to the information booth, and I'm going to ask the question about the Trinity.
Now, well, there's some assumptions in there that in this question, but go ahead. Yeah, so you're going to ask.
All right. So assuming I'm going to get there
in heaven.
All right, but let's not go to the information booth in heaven, and I'm going to ask about the. Is this a coherent concept of the Trinity?
That's a great question, and I think the first thing to point out is that there's a big difference between a mystery and a contradiction. So a contradiction in philosophy and logic, we use this term a lot. It means when you affirm and deny the same property for something at the same time. So you say...
Marty lost.
So you can't say the ball is red and the ball is not red at the same time and in the same way. You can say Smith is good and not good, and by good you mean he's a proficient thief, but by not good you mean he's morally corrupt. That's not a contradiction. Or Dickens will say it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Okay. It's not really a contradiction when you flesh it out. But the idea is there are lots of mysteries in the world, including things that are not related to Christian theology. So how gravity works or is propagated is very mysterious. We can model it. We have equations for how it's going to operate. But really, the workings of it are a mystery. So we are encountered with mysteries all the time. The doctrine of the Trinity is mysterious and hard to understand, but there aren't actually any contradictions in it. Sometimes people think that the claim that God is three and one is a contradiction. Universalist put it this way. He said, the doctrine of the Trinity represents the most brutal and inexcusable error in counting. But it's not an error in counting. We're not saying God is three and one in the same way. So the basics of the doctrine affirm that God is one God, one being, one substance, one nature, one essence. These are all technical terms that we use in philosophy and theology. But that the one true God is eternally three persons coexisting in that one substance. So the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are co-eternally God. And the difficulty comes in because we don't have any experience with something like this in the material world. We can draw analogies. People talk about how an egg has the yolk, the albumen, and the shell. and then it yet makes one egg. But there are problems with all these things. Like the shell isn't itself fully egg, mm-hmm. and the yolk isn't fully egg. And so all the analogies that we try to draw fall short, but that's okay too, isn't it? I mean, would we expect created things to be exactly like the deepest mysteries about God?
Right. I mean, when I think of a mind outside this world, created this world, so how much should we be able to understand?
Yeah, and C.S. Lewis, I think, made a good point here. He said, one of the things that speaks in favor of the truth of Christian doctrine is that it's not the sort of stuff that we would be likely to make up ourselves. Because it challenges our intuitions, it pushes us in ways that we aren't comfortable with. That speaks against many, if not all, of the other world religions. They seem like things that a person would make up, and most likely they are. So in some ways, the mysteries that we embrace in Christian theology, I think our arguments in favor of it really having God as its source, because it's surprising. It's not the sort of thing we would make up if we were just to start from scratch and invent our own religion.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Rebecca, let's book this C.S. Lewis guy on the show.
I'm on it.
Okay, good.
You can, I think he's at the information booth right now. So,
all right. Can humans have free will and God be sovereign all at the same time?
Yes. Do you have any other questions?
Yeah, I do, actually, but I was hoping you'd elaborate on that a little bit more.
Oh, sure. Well, okay, so that's another great question. Boy, you're pulling out all the big guns for the morning.
I did homework, yeah.
Well, what does it mean to have free will? I mean, that's one of the big questions. There are a couple of major camps about this. One of the camps is that to be free, you have to either be able to do something or not do it. Another camp says to be free is mostly to act on what you desire to do. And those might not sound like they're very different, but they really are. So let me start sort of from a different direction. A lot of materialists, people who think that a person is just a body, people who deny that we have a soul or a spirit or anything immaterial that's going to survive the death of our body, a lot of times a materialist will get in a bind, because if they say everything that happens in our mind, including all the decisions we make, the exercise of our will, if those things are all just the functioning of our brain, and our brain is, of course, a biological system and therefore a physical system, everything that happens in our thought life is just an outworking of determined states of matter being governed by laws of nature. So a materialist will often not be a libertarian about freedom. And I think that's very interesting that, you know, one of the major schools of thought in this, in Christian thinking, is the Calvinist or Reform position, which tends to be compatibilist. So it says, we are free because we do what we want to do. Now, it might be that ultimately the causes for what we want to do lie somewhere else, maybe with God in the case of Reform teaching, or maybe in the case of a materialist, atheist naturalist. Maybe they're in just brain states and states of matter, the history of the universe leading up to that point. But either way, they allow that we can act freely while still having causal influences that make us want to do the things we want to do. So if we understand it in this way, it's not hard to reconcile the sovereignty of God with a compatibilist account of freedom. The difficulty comes when people try to mix libertarian freedom and the sovereignty of God, and especially when you throw in this other element of God knowing the future. That's where the trouble really starts, because if the idea is if God knows the future now, then how can I be free to do something different? That would give God a false belief, and of course, being omniscient, he doesn't have any false beliefs. So the solutions or attempted solutions to that problem are a lot more complicated. I don't know how much depth you want to go into, but there's a few different ways that people have tried to model God being able to know the future while we are still free. Sometimes this involves putting God outside of time. So God doesn't exactly foreknow what we're going to do, because to God there's no fore. There's no before or after. There's just, as one ancient philosopher put it, there's one eternal now from God's perspective. Everything mm-hmm. is happening at once, and he perceives it all directly. So there's no before, now, and later. Other attempts deny that God even knows what future free agents are going to do in the future. So there are lots of attempts at working this out that have been going on for really since the beginning of Christian theology, but especially since the Middle Ages. So lots of alternatives on the table. But yes, like I said, my initial answer I'm going to keep.
Yeah, I like that.
It is possible for God to be sovereign and for us to be free in a meaningful way and to therefore be responsible.
Okay, if you have a question, we probably have time for one. So give us a call, 1-877-933-2484. That'd be a question for Dr. Brad Sickler, because you certainly don't want to ask me. All right? So we'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. Good morning. 12 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm Dr. Brad Sickler in studio. All right, Brad, I'm going to keep the questions rolling, if you don't mind. How could God become a man? I know that's kind of part of the Trinity questions, my Trinity series.
Yeah.
But how could that be?
Well, I mean, partly here I want to say there's a lot of mystery involved, too. So one thing to note, like you said, is this is a manifestation of a part of the Trinity. So one of the heresies about the Trinity that's been rejected by the church is to say that there aren't three separate eternal persons, but that there's only one God who takes different shapes or forms or presents himself differently. So the idea here is with Greek plays, so they used to have one actor play several parts, and the way you could tell which part they were playing is they would hold up a mask. So if you've ever seen those Greek drama masks on a stick, and when they held up, you know, somebody might hold up the mask of Agamemnon and say, you know, say the Agamemnon lines, and then they might hold up the Cassandra mask and say Cassandra's lines. So the Trinity manifesting entirely in the flesh is not what we teach. So it is only the second person of the Trinity. But I think it also argues against what we were talking about earlier, too, the materialist view of a person. We are not just matter. This is important in Christian teaching. It's partly important because of our Christology. What it means to be a person is to be a union of soul and body. Those two things are so closely intermingled as to basically form one new substance. But the coming of the Son in the flesh is possible because a human isn't just a lump of stuff. We're not just a bag of material walking around. But I don't really know much else to say beyond that. Philippians 2 talks about one of the things being necessary is that Christ emptied himself. And there's a lot of debate about what that emptying consists of. Did he get rid of his divine attributes? We would typically say, no, he didn't get rid of his divine attributes. But there's a humbling in taking on flesh. And that's the word picture that Scripture uses a lot. Putting on or taking on flesh, or becoming even, becoming flesh is an expression too. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else to say. It's a mysterious union in the same way that the union of our soul and body is mysterious for all of us. So we have to just embrace these things. They aren't contradictions, but they are revealed, and they are important, and it does tell us something about our own human nature. And also, importantly, Christ is the first fruits, so that he gives us a model for what we will go through when we die as well. So when we die, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, but then we await a resurrection of the body as well, where we will be clothed with something imperishable. These are all scriptural expressions.
Mm-hmm.
Paul makes a really big deal out of this in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, basically, if you take away the resurrection, you have almost nothing left of Christianity, just moralizing.
Right.
But who needs that, really? Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to be moralized, but the preaching is we will follow Christ. So he joined us by taking on flesh. He calls us his brothers and sisters, and then he leads the way, and we're the captives that will follow him through the veil of death and into this eternal kingdom where we'll be clothed with splendor and glory and the imperishable.
Mm-hmm. We have several callers, some listeners that want a piece of you. So let's bring him on. Scott from St. Louis Park. Good morning, Scott. Welcome to the show. You have a question for Dr. Sickler.
Yes, I do. I've been listening with interest, and I wondered what your opinion would be about the composition of people. I've heard that we're both a dichotomy and a trichotomy, or body, soul, spirit, or maybe just soul, the way C.S. Lewis says, you are a soul, you have a body. Which angle do you take on this, and why?
Great question, Scott.
That's a great question. Yeah. You have really sharp listeners.
I fed him that question.
Yeah. So the dichotomist, the dichotomist view is that we are something material and something immaterial. And you might call that immaterial thing a soul or a spirit or a mind even. But the trichotomist view says in addition to the body, there are two immaterial aspects, a soul and a spirit is how it's usually broken apart. And the basis for this is in passages like the word of God is sharper than a two-edged sword, piercing to divide soul from spirit. And that would indicate that there seems to be a difference. Or when Mary says, my soul magnifies the Lord and my spirit exalts in God my Savior. So the idea is there may be actually a third thing, and how these all relate varies depending on the author. Maybe the soul is a reference to the whole of us, and then the spirit and the body are the parts, and that is a little more like Scott was saying, that is a little more like Lewis's view. Personally, I tend towards the dichotomist view. I think that's the best. And I think most versions of monism is the view that we're just one thing. And they however, tend to either lapse into materialism or into dualism at the end of the day. But it's important that we're to say that we are dichotomists in a way that's different than it's not a hand in a glove. It's not a carpenter using a tool. That was Plato's view back in ancient Greece, 400 BC. His view was that the soul uses the body like a puppet. But that's not what we think. We are intimately connected with our body, and it's important that we are. We are embodied. We thrive when we are embodied, which is, again, why the resurrection is important.
Mm-hmm.
So being a dichotomist, I still say that there is a close and important unity. And the way Descartes put it, a 17th century French philosopher, mm-hmm. is that the two are so closely intermingled as to essentially form one new thing, and that we can distinguish between the soul and the body when we think and talk about them. But we can't practically do that. They're too mixed together, like when salt joins a cup of water. You can talk about the salt, you can talk about the water, but the two are intimately intermingled.
Mm-hmm. We're kind of running tight on time. I have one more question. Mike from Maple Grove, welcome to the show, Mike. Question for Dr. Sickler.
Yeah, good morning, Doctor. My question's about prayer. So in reference to that, the verse that says, you have not because you ask not, so I struggle with that sometimes. I'm just curious if you believe that God sometimes does not answer or does not let a certain thing happen simply because a prayer is not said. I'm thinking especially of the case of someone with a terminal illness. If that person's illness continues and ends maybe in death, but if someone would have prayed for that person, maybe they would have been healed.
Well, that's a great question. The passage you're referring to is from James, and he says, he's talking about why people quarrel and fight and why they don't have, and he says, you have not because you ask not. And when you ask with wrong motives, that you can spend it on your pleasures. So I do think there are things that God gives us only on the condition that we pray sufficiently for them. And Jesus tells parables about that. Some of the parables are preceded by statements like, he told them this parable so that they would always pray and never give up. In old theological terms, this is known as importunity in prayer, that we are to persist in prayer. So it does seem that God has ordained that certain things will only happen as the result of fervent and continued prayer by his people. I think ultimately, however, we're all going to face death, and in a sense then, almost everybody's death represents at least one unanswered prayer, a heartfelt prayer, a fervent prayer. So there are certainly limits that God puts on what he will do in response to our prayer. But yeah, I think it's haunting. That's actually a very powerful verse, to think that we might get to the end of our lives and meet God and learn that we had things that he wanted for our lives that we didn't receive because we didn't ask. So we need to press into prayer and be persistent and seek God's will. And when things don't go the way we're praying for them, we surrender that too.
That's impressive. All this comes flying out of your head, Brad. I mean, seriously, your memory is amazing. All I can remember is my ninth grade gym locker. 21-14-1. Take a short
That's
break
good.
And be
That's
back. Thanks a lot, Brad. My special thanks to Dr. Brad Sickler. You can pass that podcast on to friends at myfaithradio.com. And also Dr. David Stevens. What a great show. Have a great day, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.